Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, April Fool's Day, Wednesday, April Fool's Day. But this story is not an April Fool's joke. It's an incredible story. I've been telling everybody in the office about it. We're all want to read the book and because it's such an amazing story. The author of The Lost City of Z, A Tale of Deadly Obsession in the Amazon, New Yorker staff writer David Gran is with us this hour. And the book explores the 1925 disappearance of one of the most famous explorers in the world, Colonel Percy Fawcett, and the ancient civilization that he was looking for, the Lost City of Z, or El Dorado. And Colonel Percy Fawcett got lost. He'd been there several times, but he and his son and his son's best friend were on an expedition in 1925 when others were doing quite a bit of exploration of this part of the world, and they were never heard from again. And so our guest, David, decides, he writes in the introduction to his book, that he considered himself usually a disinterested reporter who didn't like to get involved personally in his stories, while others seemed to succumb to their mad dreams and obsessions. He tried to be the invisible witness, and he convinced himself that that was why he had traveled more than 10,000 miles. He went from New York to London to the Amazon to do this story, why he spent months poring over hundreds of pages of Victorian diaries and letters, and he left behind his wife and one-year-old son and, get this, took out an extra insurance policy on his life. He became obsessed, I think, with the story, and I can see why he did. But it was an incredibly dangerous journey to take. Lots and lots of people had lost their lives looking for the Lost City of Z or El Dorado. And it also has some interesting things to say about whether or not a complex civilization could have emerged in this kind of environment where there are bugs that if they kiss your lips, they can transmit some kind of poison. You don't know what's happened, but you die because your brain and heart swell 20 years later. Well, you can see why the story is pretty fascinating. And David is our guest this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls. The book is just out, and it's doing very well. I hope some of you have had a chance to read it, and I'm sure some of you know the story about this explorer. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, it's talk@WPR.org. Hello, David. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah. I can see becoming obsessed with the story, David, but to go to this place where they got those bugs that eat your tissue or kill you 20 years later.
I always say, people always say, well, you came out of it okay. I said, I think I'm okay, except I still worry about the kissing bug, as they're called, which I won't know until 20 years later whether I made it out unscathed or not.
Yeah. What was it about? You've done a lot of traveling. You've done terrific reporting on a number of issues. What was it about this story that made you go not only the extra mile, but the extra thousands and thousands of miles?
Well, the story had just kind of various elements. I mean, it's really almost two mysteries. It's actually three mysteries in one mystery, which is you have the mystery of what happened to Percy Fawcett, who was kind of the last of these kind of great Victorian amateur explorers who would venture into these blank spots on the map, and what happened to his party in 1925 when it vanished. You then have the mystery of all these other people who actually went in search of Fawcett and the city, and many of them vanished as well. And then you have, and this probably intrigued me the most, you have the mystery of this ancient civilization, this kind of, you know, could the Amazon have supported a complex society, and did it really exist, or was El Dorado and Z just a figment of the imagination? So you kind of had all these stories and all these things. I mean, the Amazon is such a haunting landscape, but I should say that incrementally. It wasn't like I just woke up and said, okay, I'm going to go in the jungle. In fact, when I began the story, I began it in a way that's much more suited toward my paltry attributes, which is physical attributes, which is in the archives of libraries. And I went around looking for letters and diaries. And it really wasn't until I had gone to Cardiff Wheels, where I tracked down one of Fawcett's descendants and explained to her my interest in trying to tell Fawcett's story. And she had said, well, at one point, she said, well, do you really want to find out what happened to my grandfather? And I said, well, you know, sure. And she then had led me into this back room where she had this trunk. And she'd opened the trunk, and inside were all these old books and diaries, and they were all disintegrating and covered in dust and mud. And I asked her what they were, and she said, well, those are my grandfather's secret diaries and logbooks. And I began to go through those for clues. And it was really at that point that I would say I became consumed and decided to do something foolish and plunge into the jungle.
And we must. You're a little self-deprecating, which is a good way to be in life. You talk about, here's a guy who's living in Brooklyn. He misses the subway stop sometimes. He doesn't see very well at night. And you're going to the Amazon.
Yeah, no,
and you've never been camping.
I know. I joke that, you know, the people say, you know, you have a face for radio, and I joke I have a body for radio, which is I'm out of shape, and I'm getting a little pudgy around the edges, and I have keratoconus, which is this degenerative eye condition that makes it hard to see at night. And I really am I'm not someone who gets a thrill out of necessarily, you know, climbing mountains or doing all these great physical things. And so this was very out of character for me, and it involved a great deal of ardor. And I did at a certain point, you know, I always thought, you know, people who become obsessed with Fawcett are known as Fawcett freaks. And I always thought I was covering the Fawcett freaks, but at a certain point I clearly crossed the line and became one myself, although I'm loath to admit it.
I know that your wife is a producer for 60 Minutes. I can't imagine her reaction. Well, I'm going to the Amazon. But it seemed to me as though I kept thinking as I was reading the book, oh, I wish 60 Minutes had followed you.
Yeah, it's true. I wish I had brought video. You know, at the time I was with my wife, when I came, actually, you know, now, you know, I'm doing all this stuff. I said, why didn't I bring a video camera? At the time I was so worried about just survival. And my wife is clearly the more sensible one of us. And I still remember the conversation when I told her and I said to her, you know, I'm doing this story and I want to follow this explorer. And she kind of said, well, you know, at first she was like, okay, so you're going to go with an explorer? And I said, no, he died and he disappeared. And so he disappeared like a few years ago. And I said, no, actually, you know, almost 80 years ago. And she said, you're going to follow someone 80 years ago? And I said, oh, no, don't worry. Lots of other people have done it. And she said, well, what happened to them? And then I had that horrible pause when I suddenly realized I dug my hole. And I said, well, most of them disappeared.
Oh, David.
Of course, she then gave me the look, and there was that long pause, and she just gave me the look, and she doesn't have to say more. She just looked at me, and she said, I hope you know what you're doing.
Right. Skipping ahead to the end for just a moment, but you're on this, a satellite phone or something, you know, trying to figure out how to use it in the Amazon, and making sure nobody sees it, because some of them may think it's very valuable, and who knows, your life might be at risk over a cell phone. But you have a conversation with your son, right? And it's about time to give it up then.
That was about time to give it up.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a moment, you know, and one of the things, you know, more seriousness because I'm kind of humorous about my journey, but, you know, one of the things I do try to explore in the book is this theme of obsession and its consequences. And there are kind of great rewards of these compulsions, and they produce kind of wonderful scientific discoveries. And Fawcett, you know, really pieced together very meticulously his theory and in his own way made great discoveries that were only fully kind of grappling with now, and he really was propelled by obsession, but his obsession ultimately cost him his life and his son's, and it was that moment when I was on the sat phone with my son that I, you know, who was one, and he's kind of, it's at that moment where you have some sense that these decisions we make also, there's also a darker side to these obsessions.
I didn't realize that Fawcett's story was covered as widely as it was all over the world. I guess you ought to tell his story here, what he was looking for, and how it captivated people all over the globe back in 1925.
Well, that was really the thing that got me interested in the story, because I was unaware of him at the time. And I'd actually come across the story. I was doing a story for The New Yorker on the death of a leading Conan Doyle scholar. And in the course of that research, I'd come across a reference that Fawcett had helped inspire Conan Doyle's novel, The Lost World. And I then typed Fawcett's name into these newspaper databases, and off came these headlines that were banner headlines across the New York Times and every paper around the world. And I suddenly began to discover that this guy was really this kind of colossal figure that had once captivated the public. And even before he disappeared, you know, stories of his adventures, how he would live in the jungle for years at a time without contact with the outside world, or would battle piranha and electric eels, or how he'd emerged with maps from regions that no expeditions had come back from, had just kind of absorbed the public and captivated them. And he really was, as we discussed a little bit, the kind of the last of these kind of explorers before the full modern era. And his powers of endurance were so legendary that even in his day, colleagues speculated about why he was able to survive for so long and was he even immune to death. And then in 1925, let me just say, he in 1906 he began to explore the Amazon, and he had originally gone into that area because it was so unexplored. It was really the last large blank space on the map, but it was so unexplored that the countries of South America didn't even know where their borders were in the interior of the Amazon, and they needed somebody to come in and map it. So he had gone in 1906 on what was essentially a suicide mission and began to map these areas, and he did that for many years. He mapped thousands of square miles of the jungle, and it was in the course of that where he began to gather his lore and legend, and it was also during the course of that that he began to uncover evidence or clues that led him to believe that there was an ancient civilization in the middle of the jungle, a place that he had kind of called simply and rather cryptically the City of Z. And then in 1925, he finally set out to find it, and he took with him only two people. He took with him his older son, Jack, who was 21, had his 22nd birthday in the jungle. They took with him Jack's best friend, Raleigh Rimel. And even though the two of them didn't really have much exploring experience, Fawcett thought they were kind of ideal for the mission. They were tough, they were loyal, and because they were so close, they were unlikely to mutiny in the jungle, which was very common on these expeditions. And so off they went to find this ancient civilization. And one of the things Fawcett did, and one of the reasons, going back to your question about why there was so much kind of lore around him and fame, is he wrote dispatches describing his expedition into the jungle. And he would write these on these little pieces of paper, and then he would give them to Indian runners who carried them out of the jungle. And these little pieces of paper would take weeks to arrive in an outpost, and they'd arrive all dirty, wet, and crumpled. They'd be carried to another outpost and another outpost until eventually they reached a city, and then they were typed up on telegraph machines and kind of blasted around the world in what seemed to many like a feat of magic. So everybody on every continent was reading about this expedition, millions and millions of people. And these dispatches emerged for 5 months, and then suddenly they ceased, and the party had vanished.
And nobody knew. His wife was waiting for them to come back. Everybody's waiting, and nobody still knows, really, what happened.
Fully what happened. I mean, one of the things with Fawcett was he was always so indestructible that nobody could wrap their mind around the notion that he could have perished. And he had warned that he might be out of contact for a while, but a year passed, and two, and anxieties grew, and expeditions began to go in search. And just to give you some sense of how kind of compelling this story was and the mystery was in the popular imagination. When the first rescue search party set out in 1928, it was led by a man named Commander Dyett here from New York, and tens of thousands of people volunteered to go with him.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. And I read their letters. You can find their letters actually in archives, many of them applying to go with him. And they were from every walk of life. There were butlers and there were captains of industry. And they all wanted to go on this expedition. And these expeditions searching for Fawcett continued in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, all the way into the present. In 1996, one of a large-scale expedition went out of Brazil. It was led by an adventurer and a financier who also took his son with him, which is kind of a strange theme in the book of these fathers taking their sons with them on these really deadly trips. And they were kidnapped by a tribe and held in captivity for several days before escaping.
Oh, you were brave to do this. Tell me, just because these stories are amazing, about all that there is to encounter, all the snakes and these bugs, and you got sick when you were there. You got some kind of parasitic stomach thing.
Yes.
But it's a little more modern now, and not very much. But what were people encountering just walking through the Amazon? What were you encountering?
Sure. I mean, the Amazon has many, many predators, and you know, obviously we think of the things that often come to the popular imagination are, gigantic snakes, like an anaconda, which can be as long as a school bus.
Yeah.
Or piranha, which we actually ate when we would fish for. And you do have to be careful about them, and we actually would eat them. We would fish and eat them as food on our trip. There are pit vipers, poisonous snakes, even a frog, which is about there's a frog called the Philobatus terribilis, which is actually quite cute looking, and it's only about the size of a coin, but it actually has in it enough toxins to kill 100 people. But the real danger, and the thing that surprised me when I began to do my research, aren't these things that we often imagine, the snakes or whatnot, or the piranha. It's actually the little pests, the little bugs you barely see, the mosquitoes, which transported everything from elephantiasis to yellow fever to malaria to bone crusher fever, and especially in Fawcett's day, his parties had no immunities against these diseases. There were no shots. They didn't take yellow fever inoculations. So he would take these parties of about a dozen men. They would march into the wilderness, and usually half his parties would die of disease or starvation. And he would often describe burying them along the sides of the banks of the river and leaving little more than a stick to mark their grave.
Were you able to get shots before you
Well, I got as many shots as I could.
I don't blame
and,
you.
so clearly, and I took malaria pills. And so, you know, you have already a great, you know, leg up in terms of these journeys. That being said, once you're deep in the jungle, you know, a lot of the conditions you experience are similar, and in terms of many of the obstacles you encounter. And one of the things they encountered, too, which wasn't just the predators, that's very counterintuitive and few people think of, is food was often a problem. And you always think of the jungle, you say, well, it's so bountiful, there'll be all these, you know, fauna and flora. But often these expeditions would go in and they would really struggle to find food because of the kind of natural battlefield, which is really kind of the greatest natural battlefield in the world. Other predators that have been there for thousands of years are just so well adapted, and they're just much more elusive, better at camouflaging themselves. Even someone like Fawcett, who was a world-class hunter, would have trouble finding food. And for example, the first big El Dorado expedition, which went in the 1500s, some 4,000 men went, and some 4,000 men died of disease and starvation.
Oh, my. What was it? Because the common idea about people who were living in that part of the world on the part of Europeans was that they were savages, and how could anybody survive living in that kind of environment? And surely the people who lived there were not capable, because they were Indians, were not capable of putting together any kind of advanced civilization. The book is fascinating, and the story is, because it counters so many of those ideas, early thoughts that we had, and probably thoughts that many of us have now, too, about what is in the Amazon. But who got the idea that there might be this extraordinary civilization that had been in this part of the world?
Well, it began kind of from very early on when the conquistadors arrived in South America. They began to heard tales and stories of a great, glorious civilization in the middle of the jungle from the Indians. And it was said to be so plentiful in gold that the inhabitants ground the metal into powder. They blew it through hollow canes upon their naked bodies until they'd be shining from the head to the foot. And the conquistadors, who, you know, any word of gold got them going,
right,
and agreed, you know. And so off they went to try to find this place, and they called it El Dorado. And El Dorado literally means the gilded man. That's its translation. So off they went. But again, you know, as I said, on the first trip, some 4,000 men died. Other parties descended into cannibalism. Many went mad. And after several centuries of a toll of death and suffering that pretty much rivaled anything Joseph Conrad had written, most people concluded that El Dorado was no more than a delusion. And most modern scientists, which you were touching on, have assumed that no complex society could have emerged in the jungle because of the brutal conditions. And it's not just the predators. They argue that because the soil gets leached of so many nutrients from floods and rains, you can't generate enough food supply, you can't grow crops to support enough people, a large population, which is a precursor to any kind of complex society with divisions of labor and political hierarchies like chieftains and kingdoms. So most people kind of thought this was impossible. But Fawcett, who really spent, you know, from 1906 when he first went in the Amazon up until when he disappeared in 1925 exploring this region, began to uncover clues that led him to believe there really were remnants of an ancient civilization. And I can get into that, but he found evidence of pottery. He listened to tribal legends. Once he was climbing a large earth mound in the Bolivian floodplains, and he saw something sticking out of the ground. He bent down to pick it up, and it was a shard of pottery. And this was before carbon dating, but it looked very old. And he said that wherever he scratched, he found other shards of pottery, and that wasn't all. When he looked out, there were other earth mounds in these plains, and underneath the growth of the jungle, he thought he could see what he swore were roads and causeways.
And there are roads and causeways, aren't there?
That's right. I mean, the most amazing thing that I discovered, which I was unaware of, is that archaeologists have found, in the very area where Fawcett believed he would find the city of Z, evidence of 20 pre-Columbian settlements that were occupied based on carbon dating from between 800 AD and the 1500s. They had elaborate roads and causeways. They had bridges. And, in fact, an archaeologist from the University of Pennsylvania is now studying those earth mounds where Fawcett had first found his pottery. And he has also concluded that these indeed were man-made, not just these roads and causeways, but the actual mounds of earth were man-made. And they were done as an ingenious way of overcoming the leaching process from the floods. You know, you build up the land so you could do agriculture, and that there were these elaborate canals and irrigation systems. And he has said that, in many ways, the engineering and labor that went into these earth mounds with these causeways and roads rivals what the Egyptians did with the pyramids.
And Teddy Roosevelt's granddaughter, isn't it, has discovered civilizations that were there 10,000 years ago.
Yeah, which is twice as long as anyone ever. Yeah, Anna Roosevelt, who's a terrific archaeologist, kind of went in and near a cave in Santarém in the Brazilian Amazon, has found evidence of human settlements and that go back far longer than we ever, archaeologists or scientists, ever imagined. 10,000 years ago, and it's so far back that it's undercutting even the theory that scientists had always assumed of how the Americas were first settled by the Clovis people, who first settled in around Clovis, New Mexico, and then slowly migrated down south. But the earliest Clovis settlement, which is around 10,000 North America, is from around the same time period as the settlement found in all the way down in the Amazon. So how they could have gone from one place to the other in the same time, it undercuts that whole theory. So basically, these discoveries were just at the beginning of this revolution and really just at the tip of understanding it. But basically, all the old paradigms are off.
We're going to welcome phone calls. It's such an engrossing story, isn't it? David Grant is our guest. He's the author of The Lost City of Z, A Tale of Deadly Obsession in the Amazon. David has been a staff writer at The New Yorker for several years now, 2003, and he's written about all kinds of subjects, New York City's antiquated water tunnels, the Aryan Brotherhood prison gang, the hunt for the giant squid, to this book, The Lost City of Z. And then he went to the Amazon and to try to find out what the story is with Fawcett, and that story has captivated people for a long, long time. Many people have tried to figure that out and have died in the process. So that's what we're talking about this hour. Join us. I hope somebody's read the book already, because it's a totally absorbing read. 800-486-8655 is the number. If you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Grant is our guest. The book is The Lost City of Z, A Tale of Deadly Obsession in the Amazon. It's David's story of going down to the Amazon to find out what happened in 1925 when one of the most famous explorers in the world disappeared, Colonel Percy Fawcett. And it also is a story about the ancient civilization that he was looking for. David, as you heard him say, uncovered a whole bunch of Fawcett's diaries in London and set out to write the first major biography of this explorer, and to solve what's been called the greatest exploration mystery of the 20th century. So join us. Maybe you're just listening because it's a captivating story, but if you want to join us, I invite you again at 800-486-8655. Tell me, because you were on your own rather dangerous mission here, David, what you had to do to make this journey yourself. How did you prepare for this?
Well, the first thing I did, my pragmatic wife insisted, was to get some appropriate gear. And one of the things I try to do in the book is to alternate chapters between the past and the present, between kind of Fawcett's quest and my own, to kind of show how the world had changed. And so, for example, I read about Fawcett's early training. And Fawcett trained at the Royal Geographical Society in London, which was kind of almost like this finishing school for explorers that had helped launch such explorers as Burton and Speke on their way, and Livingston. And I read Fawcett went there to learn how to map and survey, and he was also given manuals on how to survive in the jungle. And I read these manuals he was given, and it kind of revealed just how primitive his training was. For example, he was told that if you were bitten by a poisonous snake, to take your gunpowder, pack it into the wound, and ignite it. Or if you were hit by a poisonous arrow and the wound was hemorrhaging, to take boiling grease and pour it into the wound to help cauterize it, things that probably killed you quicker.
Oh, my.
Anyways, but so, and in my training was clearly very modern in the sense that I went to a high-tech camping store, and I guess they, what are they, I'm trying to remember the word they use them, a gearhead store, a garage. These were words I was kind of learning as I went on to this, since this is not my normal milieu. And I went to this place and, you know, picked up every kind of cool gadget I could find. I felt a little like that James Bond scene where Q is showing every little, you know, check this out, you know, GPS or, you know, this, you know, little pill will kill any bacteria in 13 seconds or so. And I picked up all these things I could, and I got myself a GPS and got myself tents and special clothing, and I got myself astronaut food and packed that all up. But the most important thing I had to do was to find a guide. Where Fawcett disappeared in the Amazon was in the Xingu area, and it's an area that is about the size of Belgium. It's an Indian reservation today. It wasn't in Fawcett's day, and it's one of the largest territories on the earth that remains under indigenous control. And because of the bloody history of the contact, you can't just wander on to these areas. They justifiably defend their territory fiercely. So I needed a guy that could help make contact, and even today, you know, there are parts of the Brazilian Amazon that remain relatively unknown. There are, the Brazilian government estimates there are about 60 tribes that remain uncontacted to this day. And even just a few years ago in the Colombian Amazon, members of a nomadic tribe had emerged from the forest saying they were ready to join the modern world, though they were unaware that Colombia was a country, and they asked if the plains overhead were on an invisible road. And so these areas, you know, you're going into areas that you need a guide who can get you through them. Now, I had spoken to the expedition leader who had been kidnapped several years earlier, and I kind of tried to not do what he did, which was kind of take a large party and kind of go in with all these bells and whistles. I wanted to go in very quietly. Fawcett himself believed very much in taking a small party. I took a very small party with just me and my guide. Now, of course, it was not easy to find a guide, and that was one of my first big obstacles, because most guides, when I told them what I was trying to do, to chase a ghost who disappeared 80 years ago, right, they all thought I was pretty much nuts.
Exactly.
And they all said they were muito ocupado, which, as I said, seemed to be a polite way of saying you're out of your mind. But eventually I did find a guy, a lovely man named Paulo Pinochet. He was a great guy. He was a professional samba dancer, and I can attest he was very good. And but he had also once worked for an agency that helped protect indigenous communities. And so he could help us make contact. And based on Fawcett's letters and diaries, we tried to follow Fawcett's path as precisely as possible.
And what did you encounter?
What was interesting, I mean, one of the most interesting things was to stand in the very same places that Fawcett had. So, for example, early in the trip, when we set out, I was reading Fawcett's letters, and he was describing the density of the jungle and that it was such an ordeal hacking through it. And at one point, he got separated from Jack and Jack's best friend, and Raleigh, who was the third companion, was already sick from the ordeal. And while I'm reading these letters, I'm kind of looking out, and there's literally no trees there. They had all been cut down and deforested. And so the landscape, the jungle, had not only changed, it really no longer existed in these areas. And so that was the first thing that I found just kind of shocking. And then from there, we proceeded further northward. And as you proceed further northward, we then entered the wilderness area. And especially in the indigenous area, in the Xingu area, the wilderness is extremely well preserved. One of the things I found was that it's actually the areas that remain under indigenous control where the jungle is well preserved and it isn't cut down. And we stayed with many of the same tribes that Fawcett did. And one of the more interesting things we found was that many of these tribes actually had oral histories about Fawcett and his party, because they were among the first white men they had ever seen. And this image of these kind of strange white-bearded figures emerging out of the jungle was something that they had remembered and recorded. And even though they don't have written records, they have these oral histories that are almost like these epic poems, and they get passed down from generation to generation. And so we got to listen to these wonderful oral histories that had great clues about what really happened to Fawcett.
We'll hear some of those in a moment. Let's go to some phone calls. Brad is calling from Calumet, Michigan. Hi, Brad.
Hello. Hey, fascinating program. I was just curious, the author's experiences interacting with these indigenous tribes and kind of the experience of the culture that he was immersed in. I just wanted to know a little bit more about that, and I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
You know, making contact with them was often difficult and involved a lot of negotiations to kind of get them to agree because, like I said, and I go into this much more in the book, but, you know, the history of the contact, especially in that area, was just so bloody. The Amazon rubber boom, which happened actually in Fawcett's day, had sent rubber barons in to often enslave the Indians or massacre them. And so getting and kind of negotiating your way onto the territory was extremely difficult. But that being said, once that was achieved, and I would bring gifts, and I would meet with the council, the tribal elders and the council, and they would agree, and I would explain to them my mission and my peaceful intentions, they were really wonderful, and they were extremely receptive and warm, and it was kind of wonderful because part of the journey where we weren't in the settlements, where we were just kind of going through the jungle and we would sleep in hammocks, we were kind of miserable because you're exposed to the mosquitoes. And then if we got to these settlement areas, you know, and one of the things Fawcett discovered was that these tribes, you know, they've been in the jungle for so long, they're extremely well adapted to their conditions, and they kind of have ingenious ways, and they have these beautiful houses. They almost look like overturned ships, and they're just enormous. I mean, they're bigger than the house I live in now. I mean, they're just gigantic, and they're very cool inside, and they keep the bugs outside. So we were able to stay in their homes, and in that area, it's interesting because you have some of the early evidence of technology starting to enter. Some of them even have a shortwave radio where they can send out words out of the jungle. Messages, but they've also in these areas done and preserved their traditions and culture incredibly well. And you know, I was just kind of amazed. I mean, when I was just even on my first day, just in the house, they were engaged in this wonderful ritual for the fish spirits, and I mean, it was just kind of incredible. It's like something I'd never seen.
I would imagine.
Yeah, just I mean, the elaborate dances and songs and music. It was really quite amazing.
And you were communicating in Portuguese or what?
Well, yeah. I mean, some of the members of some of the tribes usually spoke some Portuguese or, you know, a kind of fragmented version of Portuguese. Not everybody in the settlements would. And so through Paulo, we could communicate a little. And Paulo also spoke at least one of the some bits of some of the language.
I see. And tell me more about the oral histories concerning Fawcett that you were hearing. What were people saying?
Well, the one in the Kalapalo Indians, which was in the Xingu area, and it had details in this oral history. And I'm a skeptic by nature, so if somebody says they know something, I'm always, you know, I'm a reporter, I'm skeptical. But this oral history had details that I only knew about the expedition because I had Fawcett's last letters. And so, for example, in the oral history, it describes Fawcett playing a flute-like recorder. And Fawcett had written to his wife, Nina, at one point that I brought this with me, this instrument, so that I wouldn't go mad in the solitude of the jungle. And so in this oral history, it actually describes the leader of the party playing this instrument. So I knew right away that, you know, this was real, that this you know, that this oral history was accurate. And it described them coming in. They were tired. It describes them giving them food. And then Fawcett insisting on heading eastward toward the River of Death. And the Kalapalo Indians tried to persuade them not to go in that direction. In that direction were what the Kalapalos referred to as the Fierce Indians, which were most likely the Xavante Indians who had once been contacted early on by the Brazilian government and moved into settlements and were horribly exploited, and then eventually retreated back into the jungle by the River of Death and pretty much didn't let any trespassers come in. And but Fawcett insisted on going that way, and the Kalapalos described seeing their fire for 5 days rise above the woods, and then eventually it was snuffed out.
So that's what happened, you think?
I think that's what happened, yeah.
Right.
I really do. I think, you know, the thing, the oral history, because of the details about the expedition that are included in there, I know it's reliable. And then the Kalapalos who know that area, and these oral histories get passed down with great precision for generations, and then they know the area. I have much more faith in their oral history than external people coming in and coming up with rumors and legends.
Let's go to Mary from Madison. Hi, Mary.
Oh, what an interesting show. I will take myself to the bookstore today.
Well, that's good to hear. I like to hear that.
Some of this may have been answered, but one of the most heartbreaking and, to me, poignant parts of the early polar expeditions would consist of not only the absolute contempt that people from so-called more civilized countries had of the natives who nevertheless managed to survive quite nicely there, the contempt they had for them and the absolute disinterest in learning how they survived, but also their determination to exploit whatever resources were there, and very quickly, even with initial good intentions, one can't help but notice the same theme was repeated over and over again. Very quickly, there's the demand for the use of the native women, for the existing food supplies. Often they assume that the natives would gladly sell or barter. But mostly those tribes live on a margin of excess, of course, and quickly it became a fight to the death over the existing resources. And I wondered if you had much sense of what his initial intentions were. Was it simply to expand, to gain knowledge? And since the natives quickly understand that these outsiders are there not to befriend them, as it were, but to make what use they can of them, I wondered if any of that became apparent in the accounts that are left. How was he greeted? What did they think his intentions were? And did that hold? Right. What were his intentions?
It's a wonderful question and very astute observation. I read a little bit about the Arctic exploration just in the course of my research. In fact, Fawcett had once taken a polar explorer with him, and I read a little bit about the Franklin episode. And you quickly discovered then that their hostility in the Arctic exploration, their hostility and contempt from any of the natives, they didn't adopt many of their methods, which would have allowed them to survive much better, and they had kind of imported their own methods, you know. And it's a little bit, it reminds me, for example, the first conquistadors who had searched for El Dorado had worn armor when they marched into the jungle, which has to be the most foolish thing you could do, is to bring armor trekking into the jungle. Fawcett is a really interesting case study because he is a man of many paradoxes. He was instilled with all the racist Victorian attitudes and contempt for the Native Americans. And at that time, you know, again, I would read the manuals that he was given to be taught, and ethnology was really at its very beginning, and it's, you know, we wouldn't even probably define it as ethnology today. And, you know, they would, you know, the theories about Native Americans, you know, measuring the size, they literally would often send explorers out with chronometers to measure their heads to determine, you know, they believe, you know, they essentially did not see them as equal humans. I mean, they quite literally, not just figuratively, literally. And but Fawcett had all these attitudes, but when he went into the jungle, he began to stay with these many of the indigenous communities, and he was always struck by the richness and the complexity of their culture, and he always treated them with great respect and deference. And in his writings, you see this great paradox, this great confusion in his mind, because he's constantly, it's almost like this Socratic debate. He's got everything he's been taught, and then he has what his eyes see. And he never quite fully reconciles them, but he's always struggling to. And Fawcett refused, unlike so many people of his time, including explorers, he actually refused to let his men fire on the Indians under any circumstances, even if they were being ambushed. And once, in kind of crazy, kind of mad Victorian fashion, when they were being ambushed, he ordered his men to drop their weapons and sing God Save the Queen, and he kind of marched into a fusillade of arrows. But that was his approach, and through that approach, he was very successful at making contact with many of the tribes in the region, befriending them. He even learned elements of their dialect. And by the end of his life, he essentially lived almost like an Indian warrior in the jungle. I mean, he would paint his face. And he, in his own writings, would say, you know, basically he had gone native.
Do you think, I know that there were a lot of, there's a lot of mysticism associated with Fawcett in terms of his, which is understandable, his wife who's doing, consulting people, seances, almost wondering what happened to him. There are tales that maybe he went into another dimension.
That's right.
Walked, you know, on that invisible highway, wherever
right.
that goes. Can you tell us some of those mystic stories associated with his death?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that happened with Fawcett in the 19th century, the occult, spiritualism, was actually very popular in Europe, especially in Victorian society. And when you read the history books, you have to understand it slightly differently than we understand it today. We just most people kind of think, okay, the occult kind of mumbo-jumbo. Back then, it was during kind of this great scientific explosion where you had the development of all these kind of new technologies like radios and wireless messages being sent. And there was kind of this belief among even scientists that maybe you'd be able to peel back the other world. And the early groups that did research into this often involve like, you know, great scientists. One of the people who kind of helped come upon the theory of evolution along with Darwin Wallace was a big believer in this. Conan Doyle was a big believer in this, even though he had created Sherlock Holmes, which was like the embodiment of the rationalist mind. Fawcett early on became somewhat interested in this stuff. He kind of had a wide curiosity, and so he was kind of open to these things. Then he went to fight in World War One, and he was at the Battle of the Somme. And anybody who kind of knows the Battle of the Somme, it really was just a horrific battle. And he just watched his men, these young boys, 18, 19, 17, march out of these trenches, and thousands of them at a time, march into machine gun fire and basically get mowed down and annihilated. Yeah. And so there was a second kind of wave of his interest in this. And here it became, early on, it was much more in his life kind of connected to science, or at least a scientific interest, even though it necessarily didn't have a scientific basis. Here it really became more almost a way to communicate with all these people who had been killed. And even his writings, they become a little more fantastical. And his notion of Z also changed a little bit in this period. It became more utopian. And what had really begun much more as a scientific endeavor became almost, you know, he was almost hoping to flee this collapse of Western civilization. And so he had had this interesting, and there were some of these writings. And then when Fawcett disappeared, mystics became interested in the story, and there were psychics who tried to solve the mystery and various, like, you know, automatic writing. There's a book of automatic writing. Someone wrote a book. I guess automatic writing was kind of a way you were supposed to be channeling the spirit, and then you would write just automatically, almost unconsciously, that's trying to solve the mystery. And even to this day, there are people in Brazil and around the world, and they go to this place in Brazil where they kind of think Fawcett has kind of found this underground portal to another world. And they go there, and they almost kind of worship him as a divine being. And I think in some ways that is an extension of trying to keep the world from being almost fully known and fully explored. And as the world has kind of changed, you know, there's still another dimension where people want to go. And so there are these ideas and theories that Fawcett has kind of found this portal.
We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest is David Gran. David is the author of The Lost City of Z, A Tale of Deadly Obsession in the Amazon. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker, has been there since 2003, and has written about all kinds of intriguing topics. But this story is taken in it all, and not only was trying to determine what happened to this very famous explorer who was never heard from after his trip to the Amazon in 1925. So David, this city kid who can't see very well at night and has never camped before, becomes so involved in the story that he goes to the Amazon to find out what happened to Fawcett. And it's much more than that. The book is much more than that, because it takes in civilization and our thoughts about savages and cannibalism and the environment being able to sustain a exquisite civilization and how many civilizations may have been there. It's an all-encompassing story. And throw in mysticism, throw in everything. More phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. More phone calls now for David. Let's go to Mary from Calumet, Michigan. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I've heard that a lot of tribes, indigenous tribes all over the earth, have had prophecies of the world being destroyed by the white men, so they try to keep themselves separate. So what I'm wondering is there any way to know what other tribes around the globe there might be? How many tribes might there be that are managing to keep themselves, sequestered, keeping themselves separate from intruders?
You know, I don't, in terms of the global population of uncontacted, a precise estimate. I have seen estimates of about 100, and I think, and the majority of them are believed to be in the Amazon. Like I mentioned earlier, that the Brazilian government estimates there are about 60 tribes that remain uncontacted. Now, usually, and there's sometimes confusion about this, often there has been some contact, fleeting or violent, and often these groups are known. I mean, someone has had some encounter and they're known. But because, at least in the Brazilian wilderness, where the wilderness is still dense, they've been able to retreat. And the Brazilian government, there's a constant struggle to kind of protect these areas of land from people coming in. And it's a tricky balance. Inevitably, there probably will be more contact, and it's kind of how to kind of negotiate that process and make it where you're not bringing in disease and these populations aren't decimated.
And tell me about, now that we know that there was a civilization there, I would think that it's hard to get to this place, but eventually, and I wonder how soon, will there be major excavations? Because you want to know what's there, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that had happened for so long was that the Amazon was really ignored by many archaeologists because it was assumed that it was just a counterfeit paradise and that there really wasn't going to be anything there. There'd be hunter-gatherers, so some ethnologists had gone in to kind of document tribal life, but there wasn't the sense that you would ever find any real kind of great ancient settlements. And in the last 2 years, you have these people suddenly coming in. So I do think more archaeologists will be going in to make excavations and to try to get a better sense of what is actually there. And I do think we are just at the very beginning of this process.
Do you feel this is such a journey for you? I remember as a kid having dream after dream. Everybody had just dreams about flying. I used to dream about going to the Amazon all the time as being the most remote place. If you wanted to go into another kind of reality, you would go to the Amazon. Do you have that sense, and do you carry that with you now, that you were just someplace else on many levels?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, like I said, it was something very out of character for me. And a kind of a place, yeah, and it was so different than anywhere I had been. And I like to joke after coming back that the best part about it is I have a second kid now, and I had one at the time, and I have another now, that they won't think their dad was such an old bore after all.
Well, and some of it came, you write about your grandfather. Your grandfather was quite an explorer, wasn't he?
My grandfather really was. He was and that was my first exposure, kind of to, as you were saying, you know, little, when you were little and hearing stories of the Amazon, and my grandfather was a great photographer and kind of an adventurer, and he took photographs for the National Geographic Society, went in Afghanistan and all these other places, and I only knew him as a very old man. He had Parkinson, and he could barely, you know, he just kind of would sit fairly immobile from the medicines he took. But I had these old pictures he had taken, and they always kind of stirred my imagination.
I would imagine. The other thing, and the book goes into this in some detail, there were other people who were wanting to explore the very same thing that Fawcett was. There was another expedition at the same time. Was it a competitive thing going on? Was it Dr. Rice?
Yeah, Dr. Alexander Hamilton Rice. The Amazon is a gigantic place. It's about the size of the continental United States, the wilderness.
Woo-wee!
Yeah, it's just enormous. And but I joke that you know, when you read about all these explorers going in, that their egos were so big it could never quite fit them all. And they would talk about the fraternity of explorers, but it was really there was a great deal of rivalry. And Fawcett's main rival was this man you mentioned, Alexander Hamilton Rice, and he was one of the wealthiest men in America at the time. He was worth millions. He was married to a widow who had been married to a tycoon, and she'd actually founded the Widener Library at Harvard University, which is a great library. And so he was worth all this money, and so he would go on these expeditions, and he was obsessed with gadgetry, and he would kind of go on these expeditions that were the exact opposite of Fawcett. Fawcett had very little money. He went on these bare bones expeditions. They were really something out of the 19th century. And Fawcett and Hamilton Rice was taking like the first wireless radio in with him, and all these kind of new gadgets he could to make living in the jungle as easy as possible.
Hmm. Well, it's an extraordinary book. You must be very happy to be home. And I wonder if you're going somewhere. if there's any place as exotic or unmapped as this place, if you're going somewhere else or if you're just going to ride the subway and get off at the right stop.
Well, for right now, I'm riding the subway, and I probably, as with this story, won't know I'm doing something until I do something kind of foolish and I'm like off somewhere where I shouldn't be. So usually that's what happens with me. I get obsessed and it's almost unintended consequences.
Well, I know this book, it already is, but it's going to do very well. It's such an incredible tale and you are a marvelous writer.
Oh, so thank you so much.
I've been talking about the book to everybody.
Oh,
my family,
you're terrific.
Everybody.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for being with us.
It was my pleasure.
Yeah. David Gran, our guest, and his book is The Lost City of Z, A Tale of Deadly Obsession in the Amazon. It has just been published by, who's the publisher of it? Doubleday. It's been published by Doubleday. And we thank Carmen Jackson for producing this hour. And thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour as well. And to Rob Schroeder.
Our glory